seems to feel the same way too.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We are at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at kfarradio.com. I'm your guest host, Nick Nugent. If you want to call into the show, our phone number is 907-458-TALK. That is 907-458-8255. Today is a Wednesday, which is usually a history day. My guest today is Joan Skilbred. How are you this morning, Joan?
I'm fabulous.
We are going to be talking about a subject that I'm pretty sure will be sort of stump the band. I think you're going to bring a lot of new information to people, and our subject today is mining in the Pribilofs.
Yeah. Well, I kind of stumbled upon this and thought it was just such a quirky, interesting thing. Usually when I come in and do these shows, I kind of focus on Fairbanks history. But this story is just so unique and interesting, and it just had all the elements that I really, really like. You know, federal oversight and our natural resources and you know, what some of the challenges of dealing with managing resources in Alaska from all the way from Washington, D.C., you know, and some of those challenges that happened and everything else. It's just a great story. So, yeah, so I thought I would share it today. Usually you do these topics more than I do.
Well, we've touched the Pribilofs a few times, mostly in some of our past sessions on the NC Company and on the Revenue Marine Service and the Navy at the time they were in charge. So with that, we know there's quite a bit of history and quite a bit of history in the Pribilofs after contact, before the era we're going to look at today. How would you like to introduce us to the Pribilofs a bit?
Well, for those that don't know where the Pribilof Islands are, they're out in the Bering Sea. And they're mostly known for seal harvests. That's where a lot of the fur seal industry was best. I think that they were probably the number one spot to harvest seals back in the day. And even today, there are still some harvested, only not like what they used to do. I mean, there used to be a huge demand for it. And originally, you know, it was native people. But then, you know, when the Russians came in, the Russians were big on the fur industry. And they, you know, started harvesting seals there. And they would take the pelts and they would get tanned and they were used for all kinds of fur products all over the world. And the Russians were harvesting copious amounts of them. But as you've talked about several times, when Alaska was sold to the United States, when the Russians sold it to the U.S., which we're going to celebrate that on October 18th, Alaska
very
Day.
Soon.
Yes, very soon. So when the United States purchased Alaska, you know, that meant that the Pribilofs were going to go with that. But the United States did not have, we didn't have communities or a territorial government. We didn't have anything like that. Pretty much the governing body in Alaska was the United States Army during those times, all the way up until after the Klondike Gold Rush.
Well, the Navy had a few years, the 1880s.
Okay. But so when was it that the Army, that we got our territorial government? I think it was 1913.
Yeah, the territorial, right around the Organic Act, yes.
Yes. So prior to that, every decision about any natural resources was made in Washington, D.C., and you can imagine the communications, the challenges of all of that. Also, one of the issues that happened is these fur seals were so copious in number. And when they're, you know, when they come up onto the island, you know, seals, while they're very very agile and fast-moving in water, you know, they're just sitting ducks when they're on land. And it was really easy. I mean, they just go club them, shoot them, you know, really easy to get them. And the fur trade was so lucrative, so it just was mass slaughtering of these animals, both fur seals and sea lions, but mostly they were after the fur seals. So when Alaska was sold to the U.S., the Russians, I mean, they kept harvesting. They're not gonna quit harvesting just because, you know, that got sold. So they kept harvesting, and it took a while for this jurisdictional wave to kind of get all the way out there, and it became really obvious that there was a lot of over-harvesting going on, and the numbers started to crash. And it was decided that, you know, the Pribilofs were going to need some kind of management. But that wasn't going to come until, you know, later. I mean, you're talking in the 1870s, we sold Alaska, and it took all the way until after 1900 for anybody to really start thinking about, well, wait a minute, the Pribilof Islands belong to the U.S. Why are the Russians still out there harvesting our animals? And so there was, you know, there was this big gray area time, and there was no management. The natives that were out there were kind of taken advantage of. Sometimes they would be put to work as slave labor. And the Pribilofs are only one set of islands, of many islands out in the Bering Sea, that had these seal populations that were being harvested.
It was kind of interesting to me, looking at the Pribilofs and seals, that one of the very earliest things the NC Company did before they even became NC was they signed a deal with the Russians to buy all of the furs in the warehouse at turnover. So it really does show the value of seal furs at the time.
Yes, it was a very lucrative resource. And the seal...
30 seconds.
The seal industry... So you would go and you would slaughter these seals, and then they would skin them, and they would take the pelts, and everything else was just kind of left to lay to rot and to waste, and they would transport the pelts, and the pelts were processed in London, England. That was where all the tanneries were. So the transporting of these pelts had to go all the way down around South America because the Panama Canal wasn't open yet, and then all the way up through the Atlantic Ocean up to England.
Okay, with that, let's take a quick commercial break. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Hi, I'm Barbara Haney, and I'm running for Borough Assembly. I believe in property rights and freedom. I believe in market forces, not government mandates. Some in the Borough Assembly want to eliminate city government, and I will fight to protect home rule cities. I will support our nonprofits that make our community great and served us through the pandemic. I will work for the entire borough. On October 4th, vote for me, Barbara Haney, Borough Assembly. You can find me at haney4fnsb.com.
Paid for by Haney for FNSB.
Arctic RV is a proud sponsor of Shooter's Corner, where you get the latest news and conversation in the world of guns, shooting, and your Second Amendment rights with your host, Laura Berkowitz. Get out and play in Alaska with help from Arctic RV. See them today for your next Jayco travel trailer or RV parts and service. Alaska plays rough, so rough it in style with Arctic RV. Listen each Thursday morning at 11 for Shooter's Corner right here on KFAR Radio.
I'll second guest dinners with friends because they can be interrupted by diarrhea, gas, bloating, stomach pain, or oily stools. It turns out I have EPI, or exocrine pancreatic insufficiency, which means I'm missing the enzymes needed to digest food. My doctor prescribed Creon pancrelipase, an oral prescription medication that replaces pancreatic digestive enzymes. Creon treats EPI due to cystic fibrosis, chronic pancreatitis, pancreatectomy, or other conditions.
Creon may increase your chance of fibrosing colonopathy, a rare bowel disorder. Tell your doctor if you have a history of intestinal blockage or scarring or thickening of your bowel wall, if you're allergic to pork, or if you have gout, kidney problems, or worsening of painful swollen joints. Call your doctor if you have any unusual or severe gastrointestinal symptoms or allergic reactions. Take Creon as directed by your doctor and always with food. Do not chew capsules, as this may cause mouth irritation. Other side effects may include blood sugar changes, gas, dizziness, sore throat, and cough. These are not all the side effects of Creon.
Creon is the number one prescribed EPI treatment. Ask your doctor about Creon for EPI and visit creoninfo.com or call 800-633-9110 to learn more. That's creoninfo.com.
Weather This Hour brought to you by Long Building Technologies. Make your building the smartest around. Call Long today to find out about their building intelligence systems that will save you money. 561-3044. Or find out more at long.com.
KFAR Weather.
High temperatures reach up to 51 today under overcast skies. Winds out of the east, 8 to 15 miles per hour. Lows around 34 tonight, 56 tomorrow, mainly cloudy. Chance for scattered rain showers Friday with mixed precipitation possible at times Saturday. Highs in the upper 40s. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Welcome back, Fairbanks. This is Nick Nugent, your guest host today. Again, if you'd like to call our guest, our phone number is 907-458-TALK. That is 907-458-8255. Welcome back to my guest, Joan Skilbred. Today's subject is mining in the Pribilof Islands, an area we normally just associate with seals and probably seals only. So, Joan, you've discovered there was kind of a very interesting and influential person who steps onto the scene.
Yes.
His name was William Redfield. Would you like to?
Well, William Cox Redfield became the Secretary of Commerce, the Federal Secretary of Commerce, in 1913, and he held that position until 1919. And amongst his many duties, you know, he had to manage an awful lot of stuff, and this includes some duties regarding Alaska because, you know, we had just set up a territorial government, and so now the federal oversight is kind of in a flux state, and some things are going to shift to the new territorial government that was set up here, and some things are going to end up staying in the hands of the federal bureaucracy run out of Washington, D.C. Well, it became the job of the Secretary of Commerce to deal with the fishing and sealing industries in the Bering Sea. And there was wholesale poaching going on. There's not a nice way to say it. The Russians were in there, and they were stealing everything they could, and the Japanese were stealing everything they could. And I think that stealing is, well, technically it is the right term. I think that they went, well, nobody's going to police it, and it's there, you know, and traditionally we've always fished and we've harvested seals there. We're going to keep harvesting.
Yes, I know the government really underfunded itself. At the most, the Revenue Marine Service only had 3 cutters in Alaska. That's a lot of territory to cover with 3 sailing ships.
Right. So when William Redfield becomes the Secretary of Commerce, he gets this big can of worms plopped into his lap. And it's going to become his responsibility to make sure that our American resources in the Bering Sea, which is so remote and big, you know, all of a sudden it's his job to protect all of that. And, oh my gosh, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, they had one main cutter for that part of Alaska a Navy boat, and it was, you know, I mean, this is like almost an impossible task. But he was, you know, the kind of guy, well, that's my job. I'm going to take it on, and I'm going to do the best job I can.
And when you look at the problems with policing the area, we always have to remember the Northern Bering Sea is not known for flat, calm seas.
No. So he focuses, you know, I mean, he does a lot with the fishery industry. He gets some new rules made. He gets some resources thrown in there to help manage all of that. But what we're talking about today specifically is the Pribilof. So I'm just going to focus on what he did there. He did a lot in other areas of the Bering Sea also. But on the Pribilofs, he noticed that, you know, this was like the premier sealing grounds in all of Alaska. It had been over-harvested, and the numbers were plummeting. And he saw right away, okay, we need to do something about this. So there was a moratorium put on sealing, which was really, really unpopular. But what the really great thing about what he did there was, even though he was so criticized by a lot of other groups for taking that step, by putting that moratorium on, it guaranteed that the populations were going to bounce back. But it also put a stop to this grandfathered kind of seal harvesting on the Pribilofs. So Russians, who for generations had been harvesting seals there, all of a sudden they can't do it. And it breaks that chain of them feeling that it's their rightful ground too. And Americans as well. Nobody could harvest seals. Nobody. Natives could harvest seals for their own sustenance, but nobody else could. And, you know, we do that today. But back then, that was a pretty radical thing to do. And he really had a lot of guts to get up there and do that. So while the moratorium was on, he said, okay, when the population comes back, let's do this in a smart way. And let's take all of this and make it so that all of it functions better. He was a business-minded kind of guy. He wanted costs to be kept down. He wanted zero waste. He wanted everybody to have what they needed. And so he really took it upon himself to study the whole situation rather than just the seal profits. And he realized a couple things in doing that. One was the plight of the natives who lived there. He saw that they were, you know, they were kind of taken advantage of, and that they, you know, this was their home, and that they had a right to earn a living, you know. And he wanted to be sure that they were included in that, because why would you import people in this industry when you already have people that live there that could run it and could supply the work, and you can benefit them? They can use the money that they make off of those profits to benefit themselves in the way that a community does anywhere.
As you were researching Redfield, did you ever find anything that maybe he had written about how he developed this worldview, which was kind of ahead of its time?
No, but he gave some reports to Congress, and then the newspapers really ridiculed him. I mean, you know, it was like William Seward. You know, William Seward saw the value in Alaska and its resources, and he was ridiculed. And it's really funny how in this country some of the people that we ridicule turn out to be some of the smartest people out there, you know. Be careful who you poke fun of, I guess.
Yeah, it's like the old statement that if everyone's jumping off a cliff, a guy running the other direction appears to be insane.
Yes, yes. So Redfield really, you know, he really looked at this, and that was the unusual thing. He was the first person to look at this as a whole rather than just looking at this one little part, because all of it was connected together. And so when he looked at the seals as a resource, he looked at, okay, you have fur, you have meat, you have oil, you have bone, you have blood, You know, you have many products that can come out of that seal. Why would you only take just the fur and leave this rotting mess, which causes some environmental problems? Why would you leave all of that behind when you could also turn all of that into income as well? And so that was what he wanted to do. He wanted an entire comprehensive use of these animals as this resource.
Did he have to develop the market, or was it just, it was the market already there and he was able to move in?
Well, the market was kind of already there. And he just needed, the biggest challenge that he had was transportation. You have all these products, and how do you get them down to these markets in the lower 48? So what he wanted to do was he wanted to use the pelts, obviously, for selling, you know, for the fur industry. The meat was going to go for animal food, pet food and what have you. And then the bone was going to be used in the fertilizer industry. The blood could be also be used in pet foods. And so, but these products had to be transported down to the States. And that was a huge, huge challenge because no private company, he tried to talk several of them into it, come in, pick these up, and take them to those markets. Well, just to take the fur pelts, you had to go all the way to London. So he had to do something about that. There's no profit. There's not enough profit in it. So he Americanized the American fur industry just so that he could get the Pribilofs developed. So he sent a team to London, and they learned how to process seal hides, how to tan them, and how to turn them into a product that was just as good a quality as what they were turning out in London, England. And he reestablished that industry in St. Louis, Missouri. And so right there, so the boat only had to go as far as Seattle. The furs were put on a train, they were shipped to St. Louis, and they were processed into the various fur products that the American market and the world market would be demanding. And boy, did he save a lot of money on the cost end of things.
So this move to St. Louis literally brought the market half a world closer to the source.
Yes. And that was a very big deal. I mean, that was such a smart move that he made. And so he kind of looked at doing that with some of the other products. He had to put the producers in contact with this supply.
Okay, everyone, we are going to take a break for the Fox News state news, weather, and some commercials. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fox News, I'm Steve Rappaport. Hurricane Ian lashing Florida's west coast with heavy rain, the storm growing rapidly to a Category 4 overnight with maximum winds of 155 miles per hour.
Don't forget that Ian will produce hurricane-strength winds and massive floodings, not just where it makes the initial landfall, but throughout the state of Florida. So central and northeast Florida will also feel impacts.
Governor Ron DeSantis says not everyone heeded evacuation orders.
Life safety operations will commence as soon as it's safe to be able to identify people who may be in harm's way and who are in need of assistance.
The Fort Myers area is expected to bear the brunt of Ian's wrath. Forecasters warn a storm surge of up to 18 feet is possible. Police in Arkansas saying a person was killed in a shooting at a hospital near Little Rock. Authorities have a person of interest in custody. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
A landslide triggered by record rainfall significantly damaged three homes and prompted an evacuation of about a dozen residents and caused power outages in downtown Juneau, Alaska's capital city. Geological assessment teams determined Tuesday that favorable weather has returned the threat level to pre-slide levels. The city's Public Works Department was preparing to begin removing debris, city spokesperson Meredith Thatcher said. Of the three homes, one was completely destroyed as it came down the mountain and slammed into a second home, which was significantly damaged but remained standing, she said. The extent of damage to the third home was not yet known. Residents will be allowed to return to their homes at their own discretion. If you feel comfortable going home, you can go home, Thatcher said. The local power company was expected to restore service after the debris had been removed to the point where crews need to work. Damage from the Monday evening landslide was confined to the one residential street above the downtown business district in the Southeast Alaska Mountain community of about 32,000 residents. There were no reported injuries, city
officials
said.
Streaming live online at KFAR660.com.
This November, we'll vote on whether we should hold a constitutional convention. Alaskans, this is not something we should mess with. A convention would open Alaska's entire constitution for unlimited change. Up for grabs are gun rights, hunting and fishing rights, privacy rights, access to public lands and resource development. We could lose big. No single issue is worth opening this Pandora's box. We simply don't know where it'll take us. A convention is just too risky. This November, vote no on ballot measure one.
This communication was paid for by No One Will Defend Our Constitution. The top three contributors are 1630 Fund, NEA, Alaska Pace, and IBEW PAC.
Hello, this is Ward Mertes. More than 20 years of helping Alaskans smeared in automobile accidents and the families of Alaskans killed in car crashes have taught us a few things. Even in the private Fred Meyer parking lot, you should obey all traffic control devices. Just because a stop sign is on private property doesn't mean you have the option to ignore it. You'll be held just as legally responsible if you hurt somebody when you run a stop sign on private property as if you do it on a public roadway. The Mertes Law Firm has helped injured Alaskans for more than 20 years. It's who we are. And while we hope you never need us, we're here if you do.
Spend your Saturdays with KFAR Radio for local programs, starting with Alaska Realty Today from Next Home Arctic Sun Realty at 11 a.m. The Buzz at 11:30, a look at Alaska's budding new industry, brought to you by Good Titrations, followed by Health Talk with Dr. Scott Looper from White Spruce Medical at noon. Then it's the Compos Outdoor Show at 12:30. And don't miss Fairbanks Foodies at 5:30, talking everything food and fun in Fairbanks. Weekends just got local with KFAR Radio.
You need to celebrate the little things in life as much as possible. Getting off work early? Grab a Charbroil Brewster Burger. Taking the clothes out of the dryer? Try their chicken ciabatta sandwich. A good hair day? You deserve the deep-fried Alaskan halibut. It doesn't matter what you're celebrating, your birthday, dinner with out-of-town guests, or drinks with brewtizers with friends, you need to stop by Brewster's.
Great food, great Alaskan spirits, that's Brewster's.
By the way, if you do fold the clothes after you get them out of the dryer, you deserve one of Brewster's shakes with Oreo crumbles.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
We are back from our commercial break, and I am your guest host, Nick Nugent, in the studio with my guest, Joan Skilbred. Today's subject is mining in the Pribilofs, a subject that I believe if Joan had asked anyone on the street before this program, what are 20 things that were mined in Alaska, very likely, or where, the Pribilofs would have never come up as a subject.
No. So we'll go ahead and get to the mining part of this, because we've been talking a lot of background information. So the Secretary of Commerce from 1913 to 1919 is William C. Redfield, and he's developing the resource in the Pribilof Islands, and he doesn't want any waste there, and he wants to benefit the native population, all of that, you know. He's got a big problem. He figured out a way to solve it and was up against a lot of ridicule and not very much cooperation. In the private sector, nobody wanted to send a boat up. So if you're going to go up and you're going to get these pelts, the pelts themselves are pretty lucrative, so they would bring those and they would take the pelts, but they didn't want to take the byproducts, which is the blood, the bone, the meat, all of that. So they're worth less money. So the byproducts, he was having trouble finding anybody who would transport them out. However, He did note that the Navy was sending these boats up to supply coal for fuel, and they're going back empty. So he got it wrangled to get this industry established, the byproducts industry, that these products would go out on these ships. And there were some people who said, well, yeah, wait just a minute here, you just can't do that. But he kind of did make it happen. And once you had the industry established, then it's easier to get other boats to come in and take on these duties. Well, the mining part comes in because not only did they have, once they started harvesting seals after the moratorium, the seal numbers came back up and they were able to begin careful harvesting for the future, you know, bringing back the seal industry or the fur industry, there were these massive bone beds on the Pribilof Islands from centuries of seals being harvested. And these bone beds, I mean, it's bones, seal bones, tons and tons and tons of seal bones. Near the shore, it was 6 feet deep. And as it went further inland, then it was a consistent 2 feet deep. And there were several of these bone beds on the Pribilof Islands. And they would be like, one of them would be like a mile long, half a mile wide, and then 2 feet deep. And as you get closer to the shore, it's going to get as deep as 6 feet. This is a lot of bone. And bones were very important because after the Civil War, America started engaging in agriculture that was more large scale. And you can't have large scale agriculture without fertilizer. And these bones were needed to make the phosphate fertilizers that they used to grow crops. Well, after the Civil War, of course, you know, the railroads are being built, westward expansion's going on, everything's just great guns, and they wiped out the bison on the plains, and all those bison generated these huge bone sources. And that was what supplied all the fertilizer. But they started running out of these bison bones. You know, by 1910, America was starting to get desperate for bone meal. And it became known that the Pribilofs had a lot of bone meal. And so William Redfield went, well, you know, we'll mine those bones. So he was a bone miner, and it was a mining operation. You're digging this resource out of the ground, and you're processing it, and you're selling it. And so they, you know, he had to develop this. It was at first not easy to sell this idea, but eventually, you know, bone meal became scarce enough that they started, you know, people, it really got their attention and going, well, wait a minute, maybe we can do something with this. And so he was able to develop that. But to do this, you have to be able to dig the bones out of the ground. You have to be able to move them to get them packaged and on board a ship, and then the ship has to get them down to another port. And they were going to need equipment, so they got some surplus equipment from the Army. And especially after World War I, some extra equipment came, you know, it was more widely available. I think the initial equipment probably came from the Panama Canal is what I'm going to guess, because the U.S. had already a lot of it being sent up here. So they mined these bone beds, and over several years they mined 472,000 tons of bone meal.
That's quite a remarkable amount when you think that bones are somewhat porous. And yeah, it's not like mining
they're very lightweight.
No, it's not like mining that amount of granite or something.
No, it was miles of bones, miles of them. There were lots of these bone beds on these islands. And, you know, he saw the value in that, so they took those.
I would wonder if our bones here were a better commercial value since they had sat in a cold climate and buried in cold ground as compared to, say, the bison bones, which out in the West would have been exposed to the sun and leaching out. I'm just kind of wondering if there were more beneficial components in ours.
The newspaper articles that I read said that the bones were of very high quality. You know, the phosphate counts in them were very high, and that they would make a very desirable product. And then they, of course, they sent the bones, the fresh bones as well, you know. And when you talk these bone beds, what's on top is fresher than what's on the bottom. You know, you got a certain amount of decomp going on. But it was, I just thought it was so interesting that the Secretary of Commerce was, you know, engaged in a mining industry, and he was in charge of it. He was the head. He couldn't get a private enterprise to take it on, so he had to get the ball rolling to get all of this in place. And the natives, his goal was to have the natives that lived there to be running this whole operation, and to be and at the same time benefiting from all of this. So they built a big processing plant for extracting the oil, the seal oil, which they sold because we didn't have petrochemical products back then. So that seal oil was a very important resource, even though it was kind of hard to get until they built the processing plant on site there. So they were shipping the refined oil, not the raw materials.
So they were doing exactly what you want to do. They kept the value-added part locally rather
yes.
than just shipping out an a finite resource.
Yes. And he actually, you know, they made some money off of all of this. And it was, you know, it was pretty successful. There were a lot of challenges. There were, you know, you had to transport all this stuff. If you've ever been out to one of those islands, you know, it's not like moving down a paved street in the city here. You know, there's swamp holes and quagmires and everything, and rough terrain in places. And they had to deal with all of that. Also, the rough seas, you know, the Bering Sea is also notorious for making trouble.
Do you know if they were able to mine year-round, or was it pretty much a summer-type activity? Was it seasonal?
You know, that's an interesting question. I never saw any reports that said that it was seasonal. They just went in there and got it. I've seen some of the pictures. There are a few pictures of them with equipment, and they had these two really unusual looking pieces of equipment. And there's one where it's buried, like hopelessly mired in the muck. And the other one is trying to pull it out. And I'm sure that breakdowns were costly. And they probably relied a lot on human power to move a lot of the stuff from time to time. And you said that there was also a railroad, a tram rail, which that probably would have been the most effective for moving these products.
Okay, Fairbanks, we're going to enter our last commercial break, and you'll get to hear who some of KFAR's great sponsors are.
Coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Attend the Find Out Free Pregnancy Center's Fall Fundraising Banquet. Learn what's new at the clinic and how you can help them continue their life-changing mission, assisting and empowering women, men, and families through their journeys from pregnancy to parenting. Plan to attend the Find Out Free Pregnancy Center's Fall Fundraising Banquet Friday, October 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Lighthouse Church. For more information and to sign up today, visit findoutfree.com. That's F-Y-N-D, findoutfree.com. them.
Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies every Saturday at 5:30 on KFAR Radio with your host, David Pruse, discussing everything food in Fairbanks, from awesome recipes to all of your favorite local restaurants. Brought to you by Bobby's Downtown, Quality Food Sales, Hoodoo Brewery, and the Fairbanks Community Food Bank. Don't miss Fairbanks Foodies and go to the archives page of KFARradio.com to listen to any past episodes. Fairbanks Foodies, Saturdays at 5:30 on KFAR Radio and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Now at GCR Tires and Service, receive up to $120 back when you buy any set of four eligible Bridgestone tires, such as the Dueler series of all-season highway or all-terrain tires for your light truck, CUV, and SUV, performance and touring models for your car. Submit your rebate online. You'll receive your Visa prepaid card up to $120 from Bridgestone. Visit GCR Tires and Service for details. GCR, the tire guys, taming the Alaskan road, Van Horn and Cushman. Don't wait. Rebate ends October 14th.
Aaron Gibson here. I'm running for re-election to the Fairbanks City Council. It's been a great 3 years using fiscally conservative principles to solve problems that our city faces. I voted for changes to our road maintenance program, reducing response time, addressing problems, and increasing money spent on snow removal, while keeping a balanced budget. Fought for police bonuses and incentives, guaranteeing we have officers on the streets. With your support, I'll continue this work for 3 more years as your representative on the Fairbanks City Council. Vote for me on October 4th. Paid for by Gibson for Fairbanks, 309 Dunbar Avenue, Fairbanks, Alaska, 99701.
Weather is being brought to you by Frontier Outfitters, your store for the outdoor. Your next outdoor adventure begins at Frontier Outfitters for your Alaskan lifestyle.
KFAR Weather.
Cloudy skies today with daytime highs approaching 52. Easterly winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, lows level off around 35, high of 55. Tomorrow, a mix of clouds and sun. Upper 40s Friday and Saturday. Chance for scattered rain showers Friday. Chance for mixed precipitation Saturday. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Welcome back, Fairbanks. I am again your guest host, Nick Nugent, in the studio with my guest, Joan Skilbred. Today we've been talking about mining in the Pribilofs. I believe, Joan, before this show, if I had started talking about mining and particularly bone mining in the Pribilofs, I would have got a lot of sideways glances from people.
Yes.
Well, please yes. Continue. It's an interesting subject.
Well, I would like to finish this up, and I want to read from an article that was in the Alaska Daily Empire out of Juneau, and it was published February 23rd, 1916. And this is what Alaska thought of Secretary Redfield and what he was trying to do. And it says, Alaska's new source of wealth. And this is an editorial, obviously. There is nothing new under the sun, not even $1 million worth of seal bone fertilizer that has been discovered on the Pribilof Islands. Secretary of Commerce Redfield is authority for the presence there of the fertilizer. And Secretary Redfield is an astute and enterprising man. Besides, he is a researcher and an investigator of note. He is constantly unearthing and discovering new sources of wealth from which the commerce of the nation can be increased and therefore new business for American ships. To Secretary Redfield, therefore, belongs an honor that we trust will not be snatched from him. The guano fields and the nitrate deposits of South America threaten to soon be exhausted. And now comes the secretary with a virgin field of fertilizer, and in it and by it, he not only sees America's farmers' hearts rejoicing thereat, but he also has visions of lucrative freights for the ships that will be put into commission when the administration's ship purchase bill has weathered all the storms and breakers ahead and has become a law of the land. Truly, Secretary Redfield is a man of vision and an optimist of rare degree. He can see the possibilities offered by the Pribilof Islands fertilizer, and he does not wait. with the government owning the islands and the fertilizer thereon and therein and the ships to carry it, surely a new source of revenue has been presented to a Congress which is lying awake at nights considering ways and means to meet the extraordinary expenses that the national preparedness will entail. And hurrah for Alaska. She may always be depended upon to help out to pull a nation through. She has added $500 million of gold to the national wealth from her mines and near $500 million from her fisheries. And now comes a brand new source. May it produce at least another $500 million. And may Congress take notice and be good and kind and liberal when we shall ask for the small return in the way of appropriation for things needed, including lighthouses and other aids to navigation to guide our Uncle Samuel's fleet of freighters as they plow the deep green sea laden with the going neglected wealth of the foggy isles of the Bering Sea. And I thought that summed up Alaska's feelings about it very well. They were really excited about it. And this was all coming at this cusp of World War I. You know, we were going to need income and we were going to need resources and all of this. And it played an important role in all of that.
And some of the precursors of fertilizers can also be used in explosives, which during the First World War, there would have been a great market for.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And it was such an interesting thing, I thought, that, you know, they did this. And, you know, a lot of people would have overlooked those bone beds and said, well, that's just not worth developing. But he did, and he changed the lives of the native people who lived on the Pribilof Islands when he developed this whole complete development of this resource rather than a partial. He didn't see the value in just high grading.
We kind of left off with the market being in London at our first commercial break, and I don't know that we exactly mentioned how the market came to be in the United States. If you'd like to maybe elaborate on that a bit.
Well, Secretary Redfield decided that transporting all of the sealskins all the way to London with a war looming was not smart. And so he sent a team to get smart, and they learned everything they could about it, and they stole that industry and brought it here to St. Louis, and they established the processing seal hides apparently is not the same as processing other hides. I'm going to guess because there's so much oil involved. You know, the skins are oily, the hair is oily, just what little I know about tanning hides. It was kind of a specialized skill. And so he sent a team to learn it and brought them over here and set it up in St. Louis. And then you can just take the hides, transport them to Seattle, put them on the train, send them to St. Louis, and voila, we become the center of the seal industry.
If for no other reason than simply cutting the transportation costs, we had a great advantage.
Yes, yes. He had a great business mind, you know. I'm a business person, so I just really just admire so much what he did, you know. If you run a business for a long time, you really understand you don't want any waste. And, you know, you got to watch that cost. And, you know, that's how you make a business work. You don't make it by spending more money. Except in gold mining. If you want to make a million gold mining, spend two.
There you go.
Yes.
How to end up with a small fortune, start out with a large fortune, get a gold mine.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, we had just mentioned the NC Company, and one of the things I had read putting together my feature on the NC Company was they actually were quite responsible for getting a better quality of seal hide to the London market. They took a lot more care. They had bought the hides from the Russians, found out that a little bit of care on the front end would really realize $2, $3 more. Well, $3 times the thousands of pelts was quite a bit of money in its day. So other companies then had to come along just because they were being shut out into a part of the market where it barely paid for their skins to be transported?
I would guess that they had some pretty high percentages of hides that were lost due to rot. You know, you're transporting them in these boats that probably leaked. You know, if you got salt water leaking onto the hides, you're going to have rot. If it's damp, you know, you're going to have rot. You know, you're talking these hides when you had to go around South America. You're talking these hides being on these boats for months.
And through a lot of rather hot weather.
Yes.
So the ship's holes getting hot. Yeah, all those yes. things would not make for a better quality pelt. Certainly.
Can you imagine the smell?
Probably was no worse than a commercial whaler, but I'm sure we wouldn't want to stand downwind.
I'm gonna guess that when they mined the bone beds, I'm gonna guess that those were pretty bad smelling too. Because it's cold, so those smells are preserved, and you know it was probably not a pleasant job to unearth all of that and load it up. They had trucks and they would haul it. They had to do some rudimentary road building, and then, you spoke about a tramway. So they had this whole system. One thing that I saw some pictures, and so what do you think of when you envision a bone bed that would have been on the Pribilofs? What do you think that would have looked like?
Well, it's kind of hard to picture. I have seen buffalo bone beds where the places where the natives ran them over cliffs, and it was just a big pile and a jumble. But to think about how the bones got spread out and moved around, I don't have a good vision.
Right. And so when I studied this, I went, oh, my gosh, are there any pictures of this? There's got to be pictures somewhere. And so I'm looking at pictures and looking at pictures and looking at pictures, and I'm not seeing these bone beds. And it was bugging me. And then I thought, well, I should be seeing them. Maybe the reason that I'm not seeing them is because I don't know what I'm looking at. I have a preconceived notion in my mind, what you just described. But seals aren't buffalo. And these seals were not driven off of a cliff. And they're in a different climate and a different environment. And it turned out that the pictures of the bone beds where they were mining them, it kind of looks like these big, they're like these humps, you know, and there's a lot of organic debris mixed in with them because you had the rotting carcasses of the seals. And so, you know, it's like soil and bone and all this stuff is mixed up. So what you're getting when you pull out these bones out of a bone bed is not just these bleached bones. You know, you're getting this mixture of stuff.
They must have had constant clouds of birds all over their mining sites.
I would think so, yes. I would think so. But so when I started realizing that that's what it would be, then I was able to find it in the pictures. I could see where they were. So this was a really interesting thing to work on, and I'm hoping to work with Tom Bunsen at the Mining Hall of Fame Museum and get Secretary Redfield inducted in the future as an Alaskan miner.
I think that'll be great. That will be a very unique addition to that
yes.
organization. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's our show today. Have a great afternoon. Thank you.
FM Fairbanks, the heartbeat of Alaska.
This is a Fox News alert. Hurricane Ian makes landfall on the Sobriety. It happened within the past hour near Cayo Costa, one of the barrier islands in the Fort Myers area.
Ian, made landfall at approximately 3:10 Eastern, west-northwest 20 miles from where I'm standing right now.
Fox Weather's Robert Ray in Fort Myers. The storm coming ashore as a Category 4. Top sustained winds near 150 miles per hour and a storm surge of up to 18 feet expected along Fort Myers Beach.
And indeed, some of the visuals that we're getting out of there from security cameras and other, there are homes with the water up to the roof lines, and I certainly hope that people left, that they heeded the warnings, they didn't stay in those homes.
The storm is so wide and so powerful, the National Hurricane Center is warning of catastrophic flooding in central and northeast Florida as well, with up to 2 feet of rain.